Welcome to episode 56 of Old School Guns, the podcast that tells you like it is. And just wanted to tell everyone we thank you for the number of followers and the number of downloads, people in different states. That's really kind of great to see. It's pretty awesome. And as always, we'd like to thank the U.S. Coast Guard Band and their rendition of Colonel Bogey, which is our lead-in music, which is all in the public domain, so it's not... we're not definitely stealing anyone's intellectual property like the communist Chinese do. So, getting down to it, got some interesting things. Of course, over the holidays, you don't do as many podcasts as you think you will and all that. And some of this kind of backs up a little bit, but that's okay. We got some time today to get through it. And the first thing is, of course, the Washington craziness continues. I was hoping that they would just dismiss this stupid impeachment thing out of hand, and that might still happen. I don't know that they're going to have a full trial and whatever all this nonsense is, but you know, clearly nobody else really pays a lot of attention to all this kind of stuff. It's you know, it's had its 15 minutes of fame, if you will, and I think it's pretty much gone. But that brings us down to just outside of Washington is Northern Virginia and then the rest of Virginia. And they're standing and fighting, which is a great thing to see. And this fight is really being, if it's not being led by the NRA, it's certainly being strongly assisted. And, you know, that's a very good thing to see. The NRA took some lumps earlier this year, and a lot of people were all upset and all, you know, histrionic. But when it comes down to it, you know you can count on the NRA. You just can count on them, and that you know they're going to do the right thing. They are going to do it. Most of the criticism for the NRA is that they're not aggressive enough. But in this case, they appear to be really out front. And I attribute a lot of that to, you know, the leadership that they've got there. I mean, you may not like Wayne LaPierre's suits in his closet, but he gets out there and he can get it done. And also the second vice president, Willis Lee, deserves a lot of credit. He is all over social media. He is rallying people. He is a genuine leader, retired army officer, knows the deal, knows how to get things done, and knows, you know, what's at stake. So, you know, they've done a fine job and they really should be commended. And all the people who last summer and last fall were belly aching about all the stuff that came out of the annual meetings, well, they need to grow up and they need to sign back on and get to it. 2020 is going to be a pivotal year. There's even with Bloomberg wasting money on his own presidential bid. And by the way, have you seen his commercials? They are so pathetic. I mean, nobody would vote for that little weasel for president. I don't know. I guess he was a smart financial guy, but he doesn't look like he has anything else. There's nothing to the guy. He looks like a drippy little piece of paper, just another weakling. And so anyway, he's wasting his money, but there's still a lot of anti-gun money out there, and we've got to be vigilant, and we've got to take the offensive. We have got to take the offensive, and we got to get to the point where we can start rolling back some of the goofy parts of NFA and other gun laws and get things on an even keel. Okay, here is a very interesting deal. Last couple podcasts been talking about the reintroduction of the Colt Python. The Colt Python 2020, they kind of, I've kind of seen that, you know, written a few times. And here's the real deal. I told you, be careful that it could be a Python-like object with Taurus tracker guts. And of course, the last thing I wanted to be was that guy. The guy who says, the new Pythons are shit, the old Pythons are better. You know, I never really have bought into a lot of that. There were a lot of guys who said, the Series 70 Colts are junk, you gotta go earlier. Or how many times have we heard the thing about pre-64 Winchesters? And then, you know, especially Model 70s, and then they actually get their hands on them and fire them and find that they're no more accurate than the new ones. They're nice guns, very nice guns. and exhibit a lot of workmanship, but they're functionally no better. A lot of things are like that. Like the old the pinned barrel Smith & Wessons versus the ones where it's just kind of put in there, and I think they call it crush, where they just kind of put it in there and it's really tight. So they don't need the little pin in the top. You know, the ones that came after the triple lock, and that's, you're talking almost 100 years ago, you know, the triple lock was so much better. They actually get examples of these guns and find out that the earlier guns that have achieved this mythos, really aren't that much better, or if they're any better at all, and in some cases they're not even as good as the newer guns. So I did not want to be that guy. I was actually kind of softening on them a little bit. I thought, well, you know, let's just take a look at it. So I've looked at all the videos. Of course, they're scarce as hen's teeth. They're sold out of everywhere. Not that I was looking to buy one, but I was just looking to see if they were available. But a few've shown up on the internet. And in kind of looking at it, I thought, well, you know, if you are a person who will pay $1,500 for a revolver and want one to carry around, that's, you know, you're not really worried about depreciation of a classic that's not made anymore. You know, you don't really want to take your Royal Blue Python and carry it around in a holster every day, even if you are kind of a big successful rancher or somebody who's out on a lot of property and goes out on it every day and carries a pistol. So this seemed like a very good alternative. And I'll just kind of go through a couple quick things. First of all, the new guns are stainless, all right? And why are the new guns stainless? Why is the new Python or the reintroduced Python stainless? Well, because gun bluing and especially gun nickeling are kind of fickle processes that you really have to have down. And of course, if you turned out very nicely blued guns like the Colt Royal Blue, or you turned out the beautiful nickel, like the beautiful nickeled Pythons were just, you know, they were just gorgeous. They were literally kind of the gun equivalent of Tiffany quality. They were just so nice. But if you do that, then you know, when somebody buys one, carries it around in a holster, and it starts looking a little worn, they will want to send it back to you and have that finish reapplied, and that finish is hard to do. If you're just offering in stainless, well, guess what? You shine stainless, and that's all you have to do. There's no refinishing involved. You just shine it some more. And the debit is, shined stainless will never look as good as nickel. It just won't. It's not even close. It doesn't look bad, but it's not even close to the quality nickel that was on the older Pythons. So stainless is, you know, kind of a marketing shortcut. Plus, you know, hey, you make it out of stainless, rather than costing to put these other finishes on, you just shine it, and there you go. You send the shiny guns out. The next departure between the two Pythons, of the new Python, the departure away from the old design, is the sights are different. The rear sight I didn't really get a good look at. It just kind of looks like a factory rear sight. It's definitely not the same, though, as the Colt sight that was on there before, which was, I think they called it the Acro or whatever. You know, that sight is not on there anymore. The front sight is now removable. Now, why people want to remove front sights from revolvers, I do not know. It seems like probably 99% of the revolvers that have ever been produced do not have removable front sights, and that doesn't seem to create much of a problem. But it's got a removable front sight, just the same way the Dan Wesson was 40 years ago. You know, just a little Allen head deal. You wrench, you turn it, and the thing pops out. And you can put a new one, a different height, or I guess a different color insert in there. And there you go. You've now got a different front sight. A little gimmicky. I don't, you know, again, to me, that's probably another, it was probably less expensive to do it that way than it was to do it the old way with the pinned front sight. But, you know, that's really not that big of a deal. The next is a counterboard barrel. I should say it's got the muzzle is slightly counterboard so that, you know, you have the recessed muzzle, I think they call it. And, you know, I don't know. Again, another problem, another solution that goes around looking for a problem. I suspect that that was just very easy to do because of the way the CNC machining is going on. I suspect that that was, you know, more of a thing, and it may even been a convenience to the company. Hey, we can do this, have this recessed muzzle, and you know, that's another point. But I don't know that a non-recessed muzzle is a problem. So everybody says, oh, in case you get a ding, no, I've never really seen one like that. I'm sure that they exist, but I've never really seen one where that's a huge deal. Then you get back to really what the biggest change is, and this is the one fraught with danger, is the fact they redesigned the trigger. And I'm like, uh-oh. And they go, it feels the same, but it's got 14 less parts. Well, I would say, you know, on the surface, that's a good thing. If it's a good trigger, that's a good thing. They got a right to update the design, I think, and an updated design is not a bad thing. Gun companies kind of do that all the time. Usually it's for ease of production, which I'm sure this is. They're putting in their stainless steel CNC parts, and you know, they just kind of drop them in and go. You know, you're not going to get hand finishing for $1,500. You're not going to get the hand assembly that kind of the old Pythons had, where the parts were the parts, and then they had a craftsman make sure that when they were assembled that everything was working correctly, and if they were not, he would take some corrective action to make sure that it was right. So you're probably not getting that. So these things are out. They look, you know, they look remarkably like the old Python, given the things I spoke about. And they have the same kind of grips. The wood looks a little like they've gone to a darker wood. The Python always had kind of light-colored grips, but they've gone to kind of a darker grip that's the same contours and everything. Now, here's where it gets sticky, okay? Some of them have... There's probably now, well, there's less than 10, maybe 5 or 6 YouTube videos, as of this moment, about the new Python. And, you know, one of them is a Colt video. The other one is the guy we were talking about earlier, the, you know, Hackathorn and some other guy. And they basically go and shoot these things. And, you know, they seem to be having fine. That went fine. Then we have, apparently, there's this place, Golden Web, which is kind of a southern guy. He's, I never really saw him before. It just kind of popped up when I was searching for videos. He got one that's an absolute dog. I mean, and what was wrong with his gun, and you can look him up. YouTube, Golden Web, Colt Python, you'll find these things. And you can make up your own mind. He put up a couple videos. He did, you know, exciting, doing the unboxing and the whole thing. But when it came out to shooting, the problems that the revolver exhibited were apparently there's a problem in the trigger reset, and there were times when the cylinder would not turn, and then they would also get light primer strikes. You know, hey, that's unsat on a $1,500 pistol. Can you imagine how you would feel? And this guy he wasn't very happy about that, and he expressed exactly that. You essentially, paraphrasing him, you put all of this effort, meaning time and money, into this, and then you're going to send it back to Colt, and he said Colt was somewhat difficult to get a hold of, and all the rest of it. So he was very disappointed. And they, you know, and again, before anybody asks, yes, they were trying different types of ammo and all the rest of it. It was not an ammo problem. It was definitely a mechanical problem inside the action of the revolver. So that obviously bodes evil. But even then you could say, well, maybe a bad one. Maybe one slipped through. One of the other things that he pointed out, which was difficult to see on the video, but if you looked, you could see it, and that was... the exterior of the revolver was not as finely polished as it probably should have been. That you could see lines in the stainless steel that, you know, and I don't know that you can polish it enough to get rid of those, or what the story with that is. I don't know if they were machine marks or what the deal is, and you just can't keep polishing it, or he'll polish it away to nothing. So anyway, he was very disappointed in that quality. Just did not feel that that was, you know, that, again, $1,500 is a lot of money for a revolver. Most high quality revolvers sell for about half that. And you know, the ones, you know, Freedom Arms and some of these very, very semi-custom and custom ones cost more. But you would think that for $1,500, that represents a significant investment. So you think that the finish would be reflective of that kind of a price. So obviously that one's a baddie. And then you go to, I don't really watch many of his videos because I believe people should go out shooting and not watch somebody else shooting. But this Hickok 45, he's on there. He's got one of the biggest YouTube channels. I mean, he's got thousands of followers, thousands and thousands of followers. He got one, did the video, and then at the very end, while they were doing the filming, it started exhibiting the same problem. And he basically filmed a little intro to the video saying, hey, at the end of this thing, this is the problem that was there. It seems to be functioning fine now, but at the end of the video, it was definitely not advancing the cylinder. So whether he got light primer strikes, I don't know. But, you know, so obviously the redesign did not go as well as they had intended, at least in those two examples. And I kind of tend to believe that if you're having that kind of a problem with the two that you sort of know or suspect might go on the internet that and be videoed, that you know, you would think that the one that Hickok 45 gets is probably directly from Colt via, you know, the legal transfer process, or maybe it's even a loaner. You know, they can do that too. They can legally do that. You would think that they would have checked and made sure that baby was definitely 100%. That's just smart business. I mean, it's way it goes. Now, if you go in and deliberately go into a store and select an odd one, just a random one out of a box, well, that's a different matter. But usually these guys get them sent to them, and usually it's ones that have been had a little bit of extra scrutiny to make sure that everything goes the way the company wants. So, you know, there it is. I mean, I would not touch one at this point. I would not buy one because I'm pretty sure there's going to be a recall or there's going to be an adjustment. And the last thing you want is one of the old new Pythons and not the new Python, which has been corrected. So I would say that, you know, I think it's a very disappointing rollout. And, you know, I also think they should have probably called it a Python 2 or something. I realize marketing-wise they don't want to do that. But, you know, as I looked at the differences, everything except the trigger redesign I could kind of turn a blind eye to and say, well, you know, hey, they're updating it a little bit. They got a right to do that. But the fact that they have what appears to have done is a major redesign of the trigger system and have made it very easy to manufacture. Now, I get it. That keeps the cost down and everything else, but it's also not a Python anymore. It's not a Python. It's something else. It's a Python-like object, and that's it. But for the majority of shooters, it's going to be fine. If you want to buy one that you can actually carry in a holster and use, now this is really the only choice. Unless you find a real raggedy one, and there are some well-used Pythons out there, but you're still going to pay $2,000, and it's still a collectible of some kind, which, you know, could be people maybe restoring Pythons in a few years. You know, could be the original ones, could be. The other reason I would not buy one is I think they're, at least their intention was to expand the line. Now, whether they go to blue steel guns or not, I don't know. What other kinds of barrel lengths, I don't know. The 2.5-inch Python was a very cool gun. And, of course, we have not seen that. It's 4 and 6 inches at this point. But you could see a 2.5-incher come out. I was never a fan of the Python Hunter that had they made one in 38 special with an 8-inch barrel and, you know, with a optic on top. No, none of that, none of that. And I don't even know if a Python, even 357 with an 8-inch barrel, is a great idea. You know, but part of the Python mystique is the looks of the gun. And I don't think an 8-inch barrel improves it. I do think nickel plating does. I mean, it's a Harry Winston gun then. I mean, it's just a beautiful diamond. It's just a diamond at that point. So it'll be very interesting to see how they handle this, whether this is an endemic or emerging problem, and how they deal with it, and where the future of the Python goes. What you don't want to have is the Python to get a bad reputation because they rolled it out too early, or there was a goof, they didn't seem to test it enough. You would think that they would have uncovered something like this in testing, but apparently they did not. So we'll see how this shakes out. But right now, it's to be blunt, a little disappointing. I don't know that I would ever be in the market for a new Python. I have not ruled it out. I have not ruled it out, especially a 2.5-incher. I'll tell you this right now. If they came out with a 4 or 6-inch blue steel nickel gun or steel nickeled gun, I would probably be in. I would probably be in. I would scratch around and find the money somewhere and go out and panhandle to get the money, you know. But I might be in on that. Blue steel, I don't think so, because I already have a blue steel Python, so there would be no need to get a duplicate. The stainless steel, if I was in a position where I was carrying a revolver a lot and I just wanted to say, hey, you know, I'm carrying a Python and take that rest of the world, I might be interested in the 4-inch stainless. That would be a very nice gun to have. 2.5-inch stainless, probably really good. 2.5-inch nickel, without a question. You know, so I hope that they correct the problem, and then at that point they can, you know, expand the line. And you know, maybe even the Anaconda could come back. I always thought that was a cool gun. The only problem with the Anaconda was they introduced it at least 20 years too late. If they'd brought that out right after, you know, Dirty Harry, when nobody could buy a Smith & Wesson 29, if the Anaconda had come out like 73, 74, they would have sold more of them than they would have sold a mountain of them. Just like Smith & Wesson with the Model 29. It would have been a had-to-have gun. Everybody would have thought, and they would have one-upped Smith & Wesson, to be honest, because the styling of the Anaconda was beautiful. I always thought the Anaconda was not a great deal because it was in stainless, and I thought, you know, the blue steel, if they'd done this, given it the Python treatment, blue steel, royal blue finish or nickel, and have the same kind of handwork in the action, I think the Anaconda would have been, it would have definitely been a winner. You're just not going to get that jewel-like quality in a shined stainless steel gun. You're just not. And I like stainless steel guns. I mean, I really like them for a lot of different reasons, but they're basically, stainless steel is a great utilitarian finish. Great utilitarian finish, but you buy a Python not necessarily for utility. You buy it because it's beautiful. That's one of the reasons you buy a Python. You look at it and you say, oh my goodness. The Python should be, if it's not, it should be in the Metropolitan Museum of Art. It is absolutely beautiful. But anyway, that's where we are with the Python. Hope it gets straight, and then hopefully other models and maybe an Anaconda or a Diamondback, another very, very cool Colt gun. Maybe those would make a reappearance. So we'll see how that shakes. Okay, another very interesting gun, which has been introduced is DSA, the guys who take some abuse, but they produce a fundamentally very sound product. DSA is introducing a heavy-barreled FAL. Looks like the squad automatic weapon version of the FAL. Very classic, heavy barrel, bipod at the end. Beautiful gun. Absolutely beautiful rifle. The Israeli light barrel one that they've just finished turning out, they ran those for about a year. You know, they had enough kits to do those for a year. And they turned those out, and those were very beautiful rifles. Perform brilliantly. As good as the original. I won't say they're better than the original, but they're as good as the original. And these heavy barrel ones are probably going to be the same. You know, I think that's a gun that with confidence you could, unlike the Python, which you kind of want to step back and say, well, what else are they going to introduce? And are the bugs worked out? No, the DSA, because they've been producing FALs, they know the pitfalls. They will be very, very nice guns. So with confidence, you can order one of those as soon as they're available. And, you know, they're going to be very popular, and they're going to go up in price. They're going to go up in price. Beautiful rifle. And, of course, you can't really fault the FAL. It's a, you know, it's really a nice design. It really is. And for all those things, it's a very elegant design. So if you like an elegant weapon, kind of in the same way a Python is very elegant also, but for that kind of a rifle, the magazine-fed military-style rifle, the FAL is quite elegant. So anyway, those are two very, very interesting firearms, and I would definitely, if you want an FAL, that heavy barrel one is very, very tempting and very, very hard to resist. Okay, let us go to my favorite part of the podcast, which is questions and answers. And let me go to the first one, which I really haven't thought about, so I'll be kind of doing some free thinking as we go this. And this is, who do you think is the most underrated gun designer of the 20th century? And I would say 20th century because that's where most of our designs come from. And that is very, very difficult. And to look around, you have to say that, I always kind of back it up, because, you know, 20th century, okay, anything done in 1898 doesn't count. Okay, forget that. You know, kind of you're looking anywhere from, just say, 1890 to 2010. We'll just go there. And I don't even know if there's a single gun designer anymore. I think, like everything else, it's been mechanized, and they come out as the product of design teams as opposed to a single designer with an idea. But I would have to say that ones that are rated correctly, John Browning, all the well-known ones are, you know, they've gotten their fame. So it would be someone else who is the most underrated. Not the best gun designer, the most underrated. A different thing. I would say Eugene Stoner has gotten a very, very big share of fame. And obviously James Sullivan, a lot less well known, more kind of the father of the AR-15. So you could say James Sullivan. You know, he also worked on the Mini-14 and did a lot of things. I think that was, I think he would be definitely up there. The one that really kind of screams at me, though, is Hugo Borchardt, because he had the Borchardt automatic, and he also had the Sharps Borchardt rifles. He worked for Sharps, then went back to Germany and designed the C93. Which was the, you know, kind of the first successful semi-automatic pistol. People kind of know the name Borchardt, but I don't think they really know that he designed rifles and a very successful pistol. One of the reasons he didn't have a lot of fame was his pistol he thought was perfect. He's like, hey, it's got a detachable stock. It's good to go. This is really a nice rig. And he was correct. Of course, it was very hard to make. And it was very difficult, kind of difficult to shoot as a pistol as opposed to a carbine with the shoulder stock. It was pretty clunky. But he thought it was okay. And then George Luger, or I guess in German, Georg Luger, he basically redesigned it and made a practical pistol out of it, a practical, you know, belt pistol out of it. It wasn't clunky. It was very sleek and really has, even to this day, one of the most well-known firearms in the world is the Luger. You know, it's very, very well-known. So the silhouette of the Luger, people know what that is no matter where you are. So I would say that Borchardt is one. Definitely James Sullivan was another. And we can't even pronounce his name anymore, but Didonné Saïve, and I'm sure I'm massacring that. So, but Didonné Saïve was a protege of John Browning, finished up the high power design. Designed, from what I know, I think he also designed the Baby Browning. Yeah, the one that you see now, the little Baby Browning. I think he redesigned that from the Colt 25, a little 25 automatic. He also designed the FN-49 and then, of course, the FAL. So that's a pretty good run right there. Those are pretty cool. You know, it's very hard to think of others who've had that kind of influence. Certainly, you know, I wouldn't say the Mauser brothers, even though they kind of took some credit. I don't know if it was intentional but because they produced guns like the Mauser C96 broom handle Mauser pistol, even though they didn't really design it, they're kind of credited with that. So I think they get their fair share of fame. But I would go with Borchardt, and I would also go with James Sullivan for the AR-15 and Mini 14 and probably all kinds of other weapons that we don't even know about. So I think that's a very, very good list right there. Like I said, that's kind of stream of consciousness thinking. I'm sure as soon as I'm done with the podcast, I'll think of better answers. All right. I'm having trouble mounting a scope on my M1A. That's always a problem. I have a Satellite mount, a 4-power scope. It shoots well at 50 yards, but is inconsistent at 100 yards. Can you help me? The answer is no. I cannot help you because I don't have the rifle in front of me, so it's hard to see. But I can say there are things I would check immediately to see if I could correct it. Okay, first thing you do is see if anything loose. Between 50 yards and 100 yards, is there any wiggle in the mount or the scope or the rings or anything else? That happens all the time. So Loctite those screws, and that will alleviate a lot of problems. Okay, other problems are, depending on what types of mount you use, and the Satellite mount is a very good mount, but you got to be very careful how you put it on there because you can torque it so that it points up a little bit or down a little bit or something else. So it definitely has to be put on with some care. You know, the M14 was never really, even though it had that little groove in the send and the little hole there, it was never really designed to mount optics. That was kind of an afterthought. So it's going to be more difficult. And getting the scope parallel to the bore axis, getting it low enough so that you're not very, very high up off the bore axis is another problem. And also, you need some kind of cheek riser. You know, the best ones are actually the cheapo sub $20 kind of Cordura that you get off of Amazon. Those have worked really well. But getting all that, getting it all tight, getting it all plumbed up, it's not an easy fix putting it on an M1A, but it can be done and it has been done successfully. I would say the next thing is if you're using a 4-power scope, you're probably using a hunting scope, and you really need to use a tactical scope. And you really need 30 millimeters a 30 millimeter scope tube so that you have the right kind of elevation adjustment so you can go from low to high, have a lot of adjustment in there. And the other thing is, I don't know, if I were just shooting at 50 and 100 yards, if that's the only range that's available to you, I would say that I would probably just strip all that junk off, go with iron sights, let the counter revolution begin. But you're going to have continual problems. But if you get a scope, and also make sure that the scope has a parallax adjustment. That's the knob that's on the left side of the scope. So you have elevation, or you have elevation on the right side. You have, I'm screwing this all up. You have windage on the right side, elevation on top, and you will have parallax adjustment on the left. So, I need one of those things sitting in front of me before I actually try to describe it. So anyway, but the last one is correct. Get a scope like that, because that way you can adjust the scope to the range that you're shooting at. Because it may be your eye just isn't used to the challenge of trying to do precise shooting at 100 yards with a scope that might be a little bit blurry because it's not really adjusted for that distance. So, and a fork power scope, I don't know. I just don't know. One of the things I've learned is that parallax adjustment, that extra knob, is worth its weight in gold. So I would do that. The last thing, which can always be a problem, is was that mounting channel, that little channel on the left side of the receiver, because everybody's made these M1A, M14 semi-auto receivers over the years. A lot of different people have made those. Has that actually been executed correctly, or is that part of the problem? Because that's usually where all of these mounts have to basically interface with the receiver. So, I know that a lot of times you have to take off the stripper clip guide and put in there. All that's good, but if that channel is wampus, you're going to have a real problem with optics on that. So it's a challenging problem, and frankly, the solution to that problem is you can try some different scopes, make sure everything is tight, make sure you're using quality rings. I mean, a lot of people just put an afterthought, or, you see guys who go, well, I just mounted these rings. These were something I had laying around on my gun bench. Well, chances are those were real cheapos. And, when it comes to mounting optics and mounting of optics, there is no such thing as too good. And when I mounted a scope on my Savage bolt gun, I used Badger Ordnance mount and rings, and they were very pricey, very, very pricey, but I've been extremely pleased. I think that's a lot of headaches come out of some very simple pieces of equipment, but when they're really made to good high standards and quality, that's it. And I'm a guy who, for years I suffered with B square mounts and SNK Insta mounts and all these other things, but the two best mounting systems I've ever found are the DSA, the top cover, the extra heavy duty top cover that basically you have to screw onto the FAL, and that's great for mounting a scope on an FAL. It's outstanding. The other great system is, of course, the flat top of the AR-15. That works very, very well. And, those are excellent. And the other ones are anything made by Badger Ordnance. And they do a lot of military stuff, so they don't fool around. I mean, they've got some very, very demanding customers. And those have been the best, most enjoyable ways to mount something. Everything else always has its engineer afterthought. there's a gun that's designed, and someone has to, some smart engineer has to figure out how he can put an optic on it, and you come up with some really strange looking stuff. And I can show you a couple of Rugers that will definitely illustrate that. Anyway, that's where I am with that. Okay, are old guns inherently dangerous due to their age and the materials used? I would say that if you're going with a the answer is the broad answer is no, with some exceptions. And the exceptions are condition is a big one. A gun that's really been beaten and used for, in some cases, 100 years. When you see a very bad condition gun, you have to realize there's probably some things with it. It's not the way it left the factory, so therefore you can't fully expect that it would perform that way. So condition is a big thing. The other is, what was the metallurgy at the time, and did the ammunition that you currently have, does that ammunition fall within the safe ammunition parameters that the gun was designed for? And some guns have been converted by governments in some cases, and by individuals and gunsmiths and things who always had a better idea as another. A couple of examples of this. There was a gun called a Vertielli, which is kind of a cool, old, really kind of steampunk-looking gun. Came out in the 1870s, 1880s. And before World War I, a bunch of those were converted to a modern 6.5 Carcano. The gun was never designed to fire 6.5 Carcano. You have to be very careful of that conversion. Some of them work out very, very well, but I would be very, very cautious with it. And that's when hand loading can really come into its own, because you can produce low pressure loads that are safe. There are other guns that were the same way. Definitely, if you like the old Swiss rifles, well, the oldest Schmidt-Rubin, I think it's 1896. Is it 1896? Yeah, I think that's it, what it is. Well, there's ammunition called GP, whatever it is, GP11. GP11 ammunition is only safe in the later models. Even though it will chamber and it will fire in the earlier models, it works at a different pressure. So have to be very, very careful about that. Know what you're doing. One of the other examples of this is Norwegian Krags. The very latest models can handle, the kind of the ball ammunition made by Privy Partisan and all that. But you start going back to the earlier models, the ones made in the 1890s, and not so much. It's a risk. The modern ammo is definitely more powerful. And you got to remember, a lot of these cartridges were never standardized until the 1920s or 1930s, So Spanish Mauser was the same one, 7 mm Spanish Mauser. Well, we think that's 7x57, and it effectively is, but there were never agreed to exact dimensions and things. So, you could wind up with a 7x57 rifle that was one of the last ones made, which is probably pretty good, as opposed to some of the early ones, or ones like the Remington Rolling Block in 7 mm Spanish Mauser. Is it safe to fire modern 7x57 ammunition in that? And I would say the answer is probably no, that you really want to have a lower power hand load for that. So older guns are not inherently dangerous. It is inherently dangerous to put some ammunition that we have today in them and use them, provided the condition has checked out. Another example that just really jumps to mind is, there are people who have found Spanish pistols in 9 mm Largo that will accept a 38 Super round. An extremely bad idea. There were also 38 ACP, not 380, but 38 ACP pistols that were produced before World War I, and actually even into the probably the 19, maybe World War II, produced up to about World War II. dimensionally the same as a 38 Super, but loaded a lot less. Could tolerate, those pistols cannot tolerate a 38 Super load, even though the cartridge is dimensionally identical to the one it was designed for. But the increase in powder, and thus power and pressure, makes it unsuitable to use in the earlier guns. So they are not inherently unsafe, but you do have to know what you're doing. You do have to do research. And I've told this story before. One of the most frightening things I'd ever seen was a guy with a, I think it was a Pieta 1858 Remington, a very cool cap and ball pistol, and perfectly suited for what it was designed for, which was cap and ball shooting. Well, this guy got a hold of one of these conversion cylinders, so it could now take 45 Colt. Then he got a hold of some HSM plus P plus 300 grain bear loads. That's what he had. And he's trying to put them into this gun. Now, those cylinders have some dimensional constraints and could not take the, fortunately, could not take the 300 grain plus P plus load. And so what this guy did was, rather than saying, I think there's a problem here, he took the cartridges out and proceeded, and since they were actually lead half jacket cartridges, he proceeded, he was trying to saw enough of the nose of the bullet off so he could get these things to chamber. And it's like, that thing would have been a grenade. I mean, those conversion cylinders usually, especially in 45 Colt, have very, very thin walls. And that thing would have been a grenade. There's no steel strong enough to contain a plus P plus 45 Colt cartridge with a 300 grain bullet, which, you know, that's something that I would hesitate. I would do it. I would fire it out of a Ruger Blackhawk, or, you know, a Ruger Red Hawk, or one of the powerful, like, Freedom Arms revolvers that can take 45 ACP, or not 45 Colt, not ACP Colt. So I would do it in one of those, yeah, but certainly not a Remington 1858 with a conversion cylinder. So ammunition is the key to safety with old guns. Oh, this is easy. Which company makes the best value for money bolt action rifles for hunting and target uses? Okay, that is so easy. It's Savage. I mean, Savage makes the best rifles for the most economical price. When you do the cost to benefit analysis, they're awesome. And here's why they're awesome. Number one, they're sticker price is low. Number two, you get the AccuTrigger is a good trigger. Now, some people replace it because there's always a better trigger out there. But for the average clunk like me, you know, the average Joe Lunch Pail guy who you know, shoots and appreciates a good trigger but doesn't necessarily buy the $500 super custom gunsmith dealio trigger, the AccuTrigger is a great trigger. The AccuStock is a good stock on a Savage rifle. Now, the one I bought did not come with an AccuStock, so I chunked it and put something else on it. But really, to me, the brilliance of the Savage design is the fact that the barrels can be changed, even by a home gunsmith who's moderately talented can do it, and certainly a regular gunsmith can do it. As opposed to the Remington 700, which is a great rifle in many ways on that, but if you shoot out the barrel, as you can with some of these new PRS cartridges or with some of these new, you know, high-speed varmint cartridges and some of these other things, you burn a barrel, and guess what? You got to find somebody to put a new one on. A lot easier said than done, especially in stainless. Stainless is a little more unforgiving and likes to crack. So I would say that, you know, just based on that alone, Savage is a great deal. I mean, when I was kind of toying with the idea of getting a long-range rifle, and I was looking at, of all things, 300 Remington Ultra Magnum, okay? And that's called 300 RUM. Well, in a Remington 700 rifle, I was reading that the barrels were lasting only 500 rounds. Now, I don't know that. Now, of course, you're talking about some serious Magnum loads, and you're not going to shoot a whole lot of them at one sit-in, but it seems like you could shoot 500 rounds in a year or two, and then you've got a rifle that you've got to go find a gunsmith who is willing to put a new barrel on it. And all of that costs a lot of money, as opposed to the Savage, where you can literally order one through the mail, it gets to your house, and either you can put it on, or your local gunsmith, who does not have to be a nationally known riflesmith, but can be a good gunsmith, he can swap it out for you. The other brilliance of Savage is if you buy a gun, let's say you buy a gun in 6.5 Creedmoor, and you decide you don't like it. Well, you can go get a barrel for 6 millimeter Creedmoor, have that barrel swapped out or do it yourself, and now you have a 6 millimeter Creedmoor rifle without having to buy a new rifle. That's pretty good because a lot of people live on a budget. If you're happy with your scope, you're happy with the rifle basically, but you want a different caliber, making sure that a few other things like the bolt and magazine are compatible, you can swap that out. The other thing that's really an unknown is that Savage does make under $1,000. It's a single shot 338 Lapua, which a lot of people like and think is an excellent gun. It's a single shot, but really, when you're firing that kind of a round, does that really matter? I mean, it's always more fun to have a magazine, but really, when you're talking about that kind of recoil, it's not exactly essential. And for saving $1,000 on the purchase price, a lot of people will find that a reasonable trade-off. Savage has got some good stuff. That's a very easy question. Easy question. Okay. Do. What, in your opinion, is the greatest centerfire handgun and the greatest rimfire handgun? Man, that is an exceptionally hard question. And I have to think about that for a little bit because, and I have to say that no, you can never answer this as a universal. You can never say with any clarity, this is the best handgun, because someone will always come up and say, well, I shoot elk with a handgun, and therefore I need, a Thompson Center Contender in 7 millimeter 08 or whatever the caliber they use. That's the greatest. What's the greatest handgun for him, centerfire wise, is not the greatest one for me, and vice versa. So I'll actually go for the rimfire first because I think that's a little easier. I would say the greatest handgun is the one that I like in a. It's the pattern I like, and there's several different manufacturers who make essentially the same pattern or style of gun. And it's the Colt Woodsman style, high standard style, even to a degree Ruger makes that, and Browning Buckmark, that very nice magazine holds like 10 shots. Basically has kind of the rakish grip a little bit more than a 1911. I think they call it a kind of, they used to call it a Luger grip. And essentially a barrel from 4 to 6 to 8 inches, something like that. Usually they were 4 or 6 inches. And they're epitomized by the high standards, the Colt Woodsman line. Even the Smith & Wesson Model 41 kind of follows that thing. That pattern of gun. Ruger Buck, or not Ruger, but Ruger Mark, whatever they are now, Mark II, Mark III, Mark I was the first one, Browning Buckmark. Those are all great pistols, and I'm sure there are some more that I'm forgetting. But that's the greatest 22 centerfire right there. I like 22 revolvers, but a lot of times it's very convenient with a semi-automatic because you really don't have to. Pick up your brass unless you're just being neat. So, semi-automatic really, really does well. And what are my three favorite rimfire handguns? Very easy. basically a high standard trophy, which I competed with. I think that's a great pistol, and really turns in great act. If you do your part, it will do its. And I enjoyed it because I had some people with Pardinis looking over their shoulder, and I was coming for them. So I enjoyed that. I would have to say the other one is the Colt Ace, because it's basically a 1911, and you know, I everybody loves 1911s, and the Colt Ace was a absolutely great pistol, and then, you know, it's kind of still out there. There are some incarnations of the 1911 22s out there. They're really, really very cool. So that was a good gun. And I have to say, one of my favorites, the Colt Diamondback 22. Just, you know, again, it's a Harry Winston, beautiful type of firearm, and everybody should, you know, at least it's not only is it accurate, but it's also fun to look at. So those are my favorite rim fires. Center fire, and I've talked about the 1911 too much, so I will kind of say that, okay, there's the 1911. Really like it, like everything about it, like it in all its guises, whether it's matched up for target shooting or whether it's 1911A1 for, you know, carrying on the beach in Iwo Jima. Love it. You know, absolutely love it. But we'll put that aside and say, well, what would come next? I have to say that the next... And it would be a cop-out to say the Python, because the Python's really cool. But it would be a cop-out to say that. I think the best revolver for my use is the one I enjoy shooting the most, that has a combination of accuracy, power, reloadability, and all the rest of it, has got to be Enframe Smith & Wesson. And I have to say it's 45 ACP, either the 1917 or... the 625 is my target version, which I really, really admire that gun. Beautifully accurate, shoots cast bullets exceptionally well. You know, powerful enough that you could hunt something reasonably sized with it, but it's also target accuracy. I mean, it'll literally outshoot a gun that has been a $4,000 gunsmith built 1911 or 19 or something else. You know, it literally will outshoot those from the box. It would do that. So I have to say those are my favorites. I don't know if I really whittled them down to two favorites, but those are kind of my favorites. Okay. Now, who do you do business with? Who do you do business with? I was starting to read the previous question. Who do you do business with on a fairly regular basis that you would recommend to others? And that is a great question. Where I live, there's a place called Quick Gun and Transfers, and they are in Kansas City, Kansas. And it is an old-time gun shop, really good dudes there. Now, For public disclosure, I do not know those guys. I do not socialize with them. I'm not trying to give them a boost. I'm not doing anything. I walk in as an ordinary Joe customer, and those guys treat you first rate. They are polite. They are friendly. They are helpful. And you know what they really appreciate? They've got some very cool guns in their shop. And they appreciate the fact that I go up there and I'm looking through the case at the $3,000 Smith & Wesson Classic Hunter with the, you know, nickeled, with the long-range front sight, all the rest of this in the velvet deal. And they really appreciate the fact that I appreciate that gun. Now, I'm not going to buy it. I can't afford it. I'm not going to buy it. But I can go in and appreciate it and be respectful of it and say, that is a beautiful piece of equipment. And anybody would really be proud to own that. So they've got some, you know, whenever you go in there, they always have a variety of very cool guns. Everything from ARs to older guns to a lot of things. Very fun. Good dudes have been very, very good to me. So I would do business with them unreservedly. really, really squared away. So there's them, and for a gunsmith, if you're in Shawnee, Kansas, there's a place called Gunsmithing Only. And if you look up Gunsmithing Only, Shawnee, Kansas, you can pick them up on a Google search. I think they're gunsmithingonly.com. But anyway, the guy's name is Michael Ali, and it's A-L-E-E, not A-L-I. He's not. This isn't some sketchy dude that we're dealing with. His family tree goes back to the Revolutionary War and before, but he's an absolutely outstanding gunsmith. Very, very good. And you know what I really like about him is some gunsmiths have strengths and weaknesses, and he will tell you if he can't do a job. He will tell you, yes, this, or if the job is not worth doing. He will tell you that. He doesn't allow you to pour a bunch of money into something that you're going to be unhappy with. An outstanding gunsmith, very friendly. I've spent a lot of time in there laughing, and he's a very, very personable, very, very professional, and an excellent gunsmith. So I do business with him, and I recommend him to everybody. The other place that just kind of crops into my mind is Fort Scott Munitions in Fort Scott, Kansas. And first of all, to visit them is awesome. It's an old, I forget what kind of a thing. I don't want to say that it was a, it was this, it's this big brick fortressy looking building, but it wasn't a fortress. It was some sort of an industrial, I don't know, I can't remember what it was, but it was some kind of a mill. But it looks like a fortress and everything, you know, the very heavy doors, the thick brick construction. You really think you're kind of going back into that, you know, late 1800s fortress type of a place. Really fantastic. I mean, it is amazing that we could, you know, go in there and there's an ammunition company. You know, you wouldn't think they would be there. But anyway, Fort Scott Munitions is there. They produce some really excellent rounds. And I tell you, they've kind of breathed some life into a few 9mm pistols that, you know, I had one that I thought, well, am I really ever going to use this? And, you know, now I, with good defensive loads in it, I've got a lot of confidence in it. And this is from a 45 ACP guy. And so they turn out a lot of really good stuff. I can't recount their target, their whole, I'm sorry, not target, but product line. But those guys are really, really good. And they turn out some hellacious match ammo too, stuff that they were taking out to Nevada and shooting a very, very long way with. So they produce that kind of stuff too. So it's definitely a first-rate operation. And if you need quality stuff, they're the guys to get it from. Well, that brings to a close the 56th episode of Old School Guns. And like us, follow us. Do whatever you can. Definitely, I think next time I will give you a state of the podcast thing and kind of tell you where we're going to go. But if you have any suggestions or anything, you can go ahead and leave them in the comments on Podbean, or you can definitely email me at kbmakel@aol.com. kbmakel@aol.com. So for Old School Guns, this is it. And Old School Guns out.